anywhere.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest tonight on Keeping the Faith is Susan Olson from Yale Divinity School. We're talking to her by phone. Susan, can you hear me okay?
I sure can.
Good. We can even hear you. How wonderful. We're going to be talking about your experience as a single mom with your adopted daughter that you brought from Ethiopia, who is 6 years old now. How long have you had Salam with you?
It will be 4 years in September.
4 years in September. And what made you decide, as a someone who'd been a former college chaplain, a campus minister, a teacher, what made you decide that you would adopt a child?
I've wanted to be a mother since I was probably 12 years old. So that has always been in the plans, but it kind of became a point where it was like, well, clearly this is not going to happen in the traditional way because I was single and not getting any younger. And so I began to look into adoption. I really started looking into it probably 10 years before I actually did it.
And what made you decide finally to take the big step?
I paid off my student loans, and so I had that had been holding me back quite a bit, the financial obligation of my student loans, and I was like, well, I have no excuses left. It was kind of one of those trust your instincts and leap moments, because you always hear bad stories about adoption, and it's a scary risk, but I think all parenthood is a risk. Nobody knows what they're getting until the child is there.
Tell our listeners where you'd been to school that you had to have all those loans for.
I am a proud graduate of the University of Illinois, where I did a Bachelor's of Science in Music Education. Still don't understand why it was a Bachelor of Science, but it was. And Michigan State University, where I did a Master of Arts in Counseling, and Yale Divinity School, where I got my MDiv.
And that's a Master of Divinity.
Yes.
Which is a requirement for being a pastor in many denominations.
Yes.
And so you went to Yale Divinity School yourself, and now you're back there on the staff. Tell a little bit about what your job is.
Well, this week I'm the Director of Career Services. My title has changed so often over the last, it's almost 10 years, that I always just preface it by this week. That is work that I've done throughout the 10 years. Sometimes it's been coupled with other types of work. And so I work with students to both figure out what it is they're going to do when they graduate and how they're going to get there. So many of our students are very young, right out of college, and don't have the job finding skills that they need. So we work on things like resumes and interview skills. And in this market, we look especially at how to find positions. It's not... over the 10 years, it has changed drastically, and it used to be lots and lots of openings, and now you have to be a little more creative and a little more assertive. So work on all of those skills with students.
And Yale Divinity School, of course, most of our listeners probably know, is open to people of all denominations.
Mm-hmm.
And so you work with people who are, well, give us some examples.
Well, our largest group are Episcopalians, and then we have... second largest group is Roman Catholic, and after that it just scatters all over, Presbyterians and Methodists and AME Zion and every flavor of Baptist you ever heard of, and Lutherans and folks that have no denomination. We also have some students who come to us who are not Christian, but are really just interested in studying Christianity, or who find that they're going to get something out of that education, even if they're not particularly religious.
And people come to YDS, to Yale Divinity School, from all over the world, right?
Mm-hmm, yes.
When you took this job 10 years ago, did you think then you'd be adopting a child to raise as a single mom in addition to being fully employed?
Well, you know, I think then I thought I would be adopting a child. I didn't think I would necessarily still be doing the career counseling work, but it's ended up being a pretty nice dovetail. It's always been a goal, but it's always been a goal that scared me quite a bit. I wish I had realized it wasn't as scary as I thought.
Is Yale family friendly?
It is. It is. I really couldn't ask for a more welcoming community to bring my daughter home to. They had a shower for me. I'm told that once we finally got our visa and were headed home, that it was lifted up as a joy in chapel service. They brought us food when we came home. Everybody knows Salam and asks after her, and she considers herself on the staff, pretty much. She's just waiting for them to assign her an office.
Now, she's 6 years old. 6 years old now. She was, what, 2.5 when you brought her to New Haven from Ethiopia?
Closer to 3. She actually turned 3 3 days after we arrived in the U.S.
Okay.
And so she will gladly tell you that she is now 6¾.
Spell her distinction. Spell her name for our listeners, and then tell us how she came by that name.
Well, her name is Selam, S-E-L-A-M, and that is the word for peace, and is used frequently as a greeting in addition to the kind of concept of peace. And her birth mother named her that, and I had made a commitment before I knew what child I would have that no matter what the name was, I was keeping it, and I still stand by that decision, but I was especially happy that it was such a pretty name, and I liked the meaning of it very much.
And now, how did the birth mother lose the ability to take care of Salam?
She passed away.
When Salam was how old?
Not quite 2.
Okay. How did you find Salam?
The agency that I worked with matches children to families. And so I know some agencies you look through a listing and ask about a particular child, and I was really uncomfortable with that approach. I think it's fine for other people, but it was just not something I could do myself. So I intentionally sought an agency that made those matches for you. And so the agency made the match. I mean, you are approved for a particular age and for, you know, particular you're not approved for particular genders, but, you know, I was approved for ages 2 to 7. And so I knew that, I only knew that, and they made the match, and it's been a great one for me. I wouldn't say it's a perfect match, because in a perfect world, her mother would have been able to take care of her throughout her life. But I hope that I am a best second choice.
When you first got the word that you'd be having a child from Ethiopia, what went through your mind and heart as you made the trip to meet her and bring her home?
Oh, the thing about this process, which I guess is similar to having a baby through a pregnancy, is there's, you know, so many steps of becoming a mom. So, you know, on February 18th, I got a file as an email of her picture and her medical information and asked me if I would accept that match. So that was kind of the first thing. And I remember I was sitting in my office. It was, I think, past the end of the workday. It was like right at 5 or whatever. And I was talking about something that I still can't remember what it was. And just in a ding of an email box, my whole world changed. And it took me quite a while to get used to the idea that it was really happening. And then she was legally mine in June. In Ethiopia, there's a pretty significant lag. At the time, I think it's improved. There's a significant lag between legal adoption and the United States allowing you to take her into this country. So I became a mom in stages. When I got on the airplane, I was pretty terrified. Yet at Yale and in New Haven, it was a pretty hard time there was the Annie Lay case had just been uncovered. They were still looking for her at that time. So I remember getting on the train, and there were all of these cars and news cameras around the police station. And I remember thinking to myself, what am I doing? You know, someday I could be a mom whose daughter's in peril, and that just sounds really hard. But I got on the train, and then I got on the plane, and I got off the plane, and there she was. And I can't say that I was instantaneously a mom. I think that kind of grows. But I was instantaneously charmed and in love with her.
Now, you've been writing a blog called The Sky is Laughing about your experience with Salaam from the time you got her at age 3 up to now. How did you get started writing a blog? But before you answer, I do need to tell listeners, you can join this conversation. I get excited and sometimes I forget to invite you. But I'm eager to have people call in and also ask questions or make comments or share their experiences. And the numbers, 1-800-222-9455, anywhere you can hear this program, even on the internet. Again, that's 800-222-9455. For people in the local area, the 217 area code near Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, where the program originates, punch in 333-9455. So long distance, 800-222-WILL, locally 333-WILL. To talk with Susan Olson on the staff at Yale Divinity School, we're talking about her being a single mom and adopting a daughter from Ethiopia and writing a blog about it. The sky is laughing. So how did you start writing the blog and why?
I've always been a writer of sorts. I mean, just played with writing, and it just became something that I thought I would do because I read so many other adoption blogs that were really helpful to me when I was in the process. But then when I knew more about Salaam, and one of the hardest things is that, you know, as joyful as our life is now, I don't have anything from her earliest years. There are no photos. There are no stories. I don't know what her first word was. I don't know when she learned to walk. I don't know how she got this tiny little scar on her face. Like, those stories are just lost because her mother is lost. So it became important to me through the blog and also a little bit through Facebook to record the stories now so that if I am not there or if I am not remembering everything, there is still a record for her of what her life was like and also how very, very, very wanted and loved she is. So it just became a way to kind of collect those stories. And initially it was really just sharing with my family and a few close friends. And then, you know, there's a few more readers than that now. but that was the whole impetus, is just saving the story.
Don't be too modest. Your blog is popular and widely read, and you're followed on Facebook. Tell listeners who'd like to do that how to find you. Of course, they can just search for The Sky is Laughing blog, and that'll pull it up. But what about on Facebook?
I don't have, like, an official Facebook presence. I'm just friends with the people I actually know on Facebook.
I see, okay.
So people who don't know me can't really follow me there, but the blog is thesskyislaughing.wordpress.com.
The sky is laughing.wordpress.com.
Yeah.
And I highly recommend it. It's quite entertaining. In fact, I'm going to ask Susan later to read a little bit from it so people can get a sense of it. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit more about your background. You're not only on the staff of Yale Divinity School, you do preaching still when asked. Where did you preach this morning?
This morning I was at Valley Presbyterian Church, which is up, I don't even know where it is in Connecticut. I think it might be Northwest, but I'm not really sure. I just know how to get there. But it's up near Newtown, Connecticut. It's a wonderful congregation, and had a really great morning with them.
And I know you also preach in other denominations. Give us some examples.
I have frequently preached for the United Church of Christ, which is the largest denomination, not the largest denomination, but the there aren't very many Presbyterians here. So there are lots of UCC churches, and hence my opportunities are greater. There's one church in Reading, Connecticut that I have preached for the last 5 or 6 years, ranging from summer, I think I'm there 6 times, and some summers I've been there the entire summer. So that's a congregation that I feel I know really well. Recently, I've begun preaching for Lutheran churches because Presbyterians and Lutherans are now in full communion. And that has been interesting because if we're in full communion, but it is a completely different style of worship. And so it's been fun. It's been fun to put myself into a different place and different style and way of being. So I love Pulpit Supply. I am booked every Sunday of the summer, with the exception of next Sunday when I'm on vacation. But I really, really love to preach.
Now, when when you preach in a Lutheran church, since they have a higher form of liturgy, often includes singing by the pastor, and since you are a music education trained person and a good singer, do you get a chance to actually sing as you're leading worship?
Well, yes, the liturgy is sung, but I'm not very good at that. You know, I'm used to more melodic things, and this is chanted. So I do it, but I'm not very good, and there have been some rather dismal failures on my part in singing the liturgy. A few weeks ago, I was at a really great church that I'm going back to later this summer and didn't realize I was expected to sing the liturgy, and all of a sudden there's this silence, and the lay leader's looking at me, and the choir director's looking at me, and I'm sight reading. but it's fun. I think it's very beautiful when it's done well, and hopefully someday I will be able to do it well.
You've been a college chaplain. Remind me where.
Sure. I spent 6 years at Wilson College, which is a very small Presbyterian college. It was a women's college at the time that I was there, but they just voted this spring to become co-ed. And then I spent 4 years at Wesley College, which is a United Methodist college in Delaware. Then I came to Yale, and for 4 years I moonlighted. 1 year at a very small college, not a small college, but a smallish college called Connecticut College, where I was very part-time as the Protestant chaplain. And then for 3 years, I was half-time in the university chaplain's office at Yale during a time of some significant transition. And that was great, great fun. I reduced my hours at the Divinity School and was going up and down the hill working with a wide variety of people. It was really fun.
And you still preach occasionally in the chapel at Yale Divinity School?
I do. You only get invited every once every couple of years, and so there's a little bit of nervousness attached to that, but I preach this year, and it is always an honor to preach in a place where so many really great people have gone before you. But I help in leading worship a lot more frequently than that, with leading prayers and sometimes presiding at communion and things like that.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Reverend Susan Olson, who is on the staff at Yale Divinity School. She is Director of Career Services there, helping graduates find positions after they graduate from those degrees there at Yale. She has adopted a daughter from Ethiopia who is now 6, and in just a minute I'm going to ask her to read from one of her blogs just to give us a sense of how she writes. But before that, let's hear an announcement about a locally produced program here at WILL-AM. It's called Focus, and let's hear what's coming up tomorrow.
What do you think of when you hear the word circus? Probably not a college campus. I'm Lindsay Moon, and coming up Monday on Focus, I'll talk with Marcus Alwan about the Gamma Phi Circus at Illinois State University. It's one of the oldest collegiate circuses in the country, and next week kicks off their final circus camp for the summer. We'll also listen back to a conversation with Duncan Wall. He's author of the book The Ordinary Acrobat, A Journey into the Wondrous World of the Circus, Past and Present. That's Monday morning at 10 on Focus.
That was Lindsay Moon, who's ordinarily the producer of Focus, but Jim Meadows, the usual host, is busy elsewhere, and so Lindsay's going to be the on-air host tomorrow. Should be an interesting program. But back to our live program today, and let me just give the information. We're talking with Susan Olson, and again, listeners may call in with comments or questions, 800-222-9455, or if you're it's a local number within the 217 area code. Punch in 333-9455 to talk with Susan Olson. I know most of our listeners are happy just to listen, and that's great, but if you'd like to call, we're happy to have you. I might just mention that coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, July 14, 2013, we'll be talking with Dr. Todd Farley about his MIME ministry. You might wonder how we can talk for an hour with a mime and have you hear anything, but you'll just have to listen next week to find out how that works. On July 21st, we'll be talking with a nationally known poet, Jeannie Murray Walker from Delaware. She's written a prose book about her mother's experience with Alzheimer's. It's called The Geography of Memory: A Pilgrimage Through Alzheimer's. That'll be July 21st, 2013, here on WILL. And on July 28, we'll be talking with Jim Hires, who's the director of the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, about that program that's so effective here and nationally. Let's get back to talking with Susan about Salaam. Would you give us a sample of something you've written about your experiences with her from your blog, The Sky is Laughing?
Sure. You had asked earlier about my experience of actually meeting her, so I pulled up that essay, which was the first one on the blog. It's the oldest one there. It was actually originally written on Facebook before I decided I ought to put this in a place a little more public, a little more... a little less cluttered. So it's called The Day I Met Her. And in it, I refer to Alex, who is a friend and another Presbyterian minister, Alex Hendrickson, who herself has adopted from Guatemala, and she accompanied me on the trip. We got into Bull Airport at about 11:30 a.m. Customs, security, and the ride home are all a blur to me. We checked into the guest house, brought our bags up, and called Aracheklu. He agreed that we should come to the orphanage at 4 p.m., after nap time for those not in the toddler set. There was some confusion about how we were to arrive, but once that was resolved, we were on our way. The whole ride over, all I could think of was whether or not I would be any good at this. The car pulled in, and we parked behind a large van. As we were parking, I saw her. She was wearing brown knit pants and a pink sweatshirt, and was playing with some older boys. I grabbed Alex's hand. That's her. I didn't cry. I wanted to. As I got out of the car, all the boys were yelling, "Salam's mama, Salam's mama." The sea of children opened, and Salam walked through and right past me. She went up to Z, the interpreter that rode with us, and asked him, I'm told, why he didn't drive in a bigger car. She pointed to the big van next to him for emphasis. I'm not sure how he answered her. All I know is in that brief second after that, things went very quickly. Aracheklu greeted me, and someone pushed her forward. The children, a staff member, Aracheklu, I don't know. And there she was. I picked her up and said, there you are. Of all the things to say, there you are. Like she was a puppy that had been hiding in the closet, my spare sunglasses under the couch, the winter scarf I thought I lost. There you are. But there she was. She liked my necklace and played with it while I checked her out. Her braids were fuzzy, and lunch was still on her chin. Her eyes were full moons of light and mischief and tomorrow. Around us, children swirled, demanded photos from Alex, and wanted both of us to pick them up. They examined the car, the driver, the interpreter, asked us for cookies and stickers, and rides on empty hips. We waded through the crowd. Maybe Alex stopped to play, I can't remember. We followed Otto Tekelu into the nurse's office, where they told me things about her health that I can no longer remember. She sat on my lap like she'd been making payments on it for months and finally owned it. We had about an hour together that day. I gave Alex a lot of stickers, and she sort of got bum-rushed by the children in distributing them, though it did buy me some minutes. She called me Mama that day. But mostly, she called me Gawadania, which means friend, I thought. A few days later, a guest house staff member told me that Gawadania is one of the few different words for friends. Literally, though, he said it means someone who is lost and is now found. It makes it all together, he said. So there you are. There you are. There you are.
Susan Olson reading from her first blog, From the Sky is Laughing. Susan, you mentioned the orphanage. How long had Salam been there?
She was in institutional care for about 13 months at two different places. She began in a smaller facility in the north, and where she's from, and then was transferred to the facility in Addis Ababa when she was approved for adoption. And because of delays through the United States government, she ended up being there 6.5 months or so.
And you said she was almost three when you finally found her. What do you know about her father? You mentioned her mother had died.
Don't know anything about her father.
Okay. In one of your recent blogs, in fact, it may have even been your last one, I had a paragraph I wanted to share with people where you'd gone to the beach, and you weren't sure it was worth all the effort, but you say that Salam runs to the water, leaping over the line where the tide deposits all the shells, a few goose steps. It's cold! A few more. And then she dives under the water, her brown head bobbing, slick as an otter in the shallow waves. She's back and chattering, singing the song of the waves and the cold and the sand and the potential of sand castles and cartwheels and sand angels. Every child at the beach is a potential friend. Hi, do you want to be my new friend? They slither in the brown sugar, building castles, digging holes, finding rocks and shells that sparkle under the water, though when dry, are merely gray and brown. Then you talk about snacks and the bubble wands and all of this, and at the end you say, we leave to grab dinner, and then home and spent, we drag the wet things into the apartment. There's always a bag of rocks and shells, dull and flat in the Ziploc bag. I thought they were pretty, she cries. They are, of course. Just add water. Reading from a recent blog of a trip to the beach in Connecticut, written by Susan Olson from her blog, The Sky is Laughing. What kind of response have you got from your blog?
I don't know. I mean, I some people write comments, and you know, the number, like, you can see on a blog how many people are reading, and the numbers are much higher than those that comment. So I always kind of wonder, you know, who those people are and what draws them there. One of the things about having a blog is you read other bloggers, and then eventually you end up meeting them in real life, and it's always a little peculiar. I was at the zoo one day with Salam, probably 2 years ago maybe, and someone came up to me and asked if I was Susan Olson, and I'm like, this is really odd, but she's somebody who read my blog and who had also adopted children from Ethiopia. So, you know, I guess I don't know exactly what the response is. A lot of it is a mystery, and I think that's fine for me. I'm not particularly writing for an audience. The audience just comes along. Mostly I'm just writing to remember.
When you go out to preach, you take Salam with you?
I do, yes. She is the quintessential preacher's kid.
Does she always sit alone, or do you find do you put her in the Sunday schools or whatever they have during church?
It depends on the church, and it depends on the day. So today she happened to be the only child at the church, and we've been there before, and there have been other children, but today there were no other kids. So she sat by herself. Sometimes she wants to sit with adults, and sometimes she didn't. Today she didn't, and she had... they have those cloth bags full of books to color and things at the church, and she was playing with those and did just fine. Other times she sits by herself and she's not happy about that and will sometimes come and join me. If there's Sunday school, she's always happy to go. She is the most adaptable kid that I have ever met in terms of, you know, church and public spaces, and she really loves people. And I think she shook every single hand today during the passing of the peace. She's really outgoing.
When there's a children's sermon in the service, does she come forward with the other kids?
She does, and she's getting better about it. When she was much younger, she was not real crazy about sharing me with other people. And would sometimes get a little, not pouty, but a little sad about the fact that I was talking with all the children and not just her. But she's getting much better about that, and actually likes that she usually knows the story ahead of time. And sometimes will, you know, hold a book or take a different kind of role there, which if I were permanently in the church, that would become problematic. But because I'm a visitor, I don't feel like it's much of a problem to have your own kid in a little bit of a small spotlight there.
I remember many years ago when our first child was two, at one point he escaped my wife's clutches and ran toward me up in the pulpit, and I sort of picked him up so he wouldn't scream until Nadja could come and rescue him and me. but you don't have an assigned helper like that as a single mom. What do you do when something like that happens?
I just preach with her there. I mean, again, she's getting older, and she really loves crowds, so she's generally fine. But when she was younger, there were times when she just decided she was sitting with me, and so she just was. And I've preached whole sermons with a three-year-old wrapped around my leg, and I've done communion with her on my hip. It just, you know, she is my calling, and she is my vocation. Not that she's my whole vocation or my whole calling, but she's a big piece of that, and so I'm not going to push her away. So, and luckily, the churches where I've been, they're all fine with that. But you know, again, she's getting big, and she's so energized by crowds. She's a classic extroverted child.
Did that develop slowly, or was that the way she came to you?
Both. That is the way she was described by people who knew her in Ethiopia. And then when she came home, of course, everything was new. I mean, she didn't speak the language. She didn't know the food. It smells different here. It sounds different here. And she was much more shy then. You know, we were both going through enormous transitions. But pretty quickly, her natural personality has come back again. And now I'm like, oh, yeah, I see why you say that. Because she's just really, really outgoing.
When you first met her, you said she was almost three. I realize you need to realize you don't have to answer every question I ask, but how old were you? That's my question. Like I say, you don't have to answer that.
Well, so I'm thinking 783, because that's what I usually say. But I was in my mid-40s. I just barely made it under the age limit. I am definitely an older mom.
Now, one reason I ask is, of course, people who are hearing you only on the radio who don't know you, you have a very youthful-sounding voice. So some of the difficulties with dealing with a 3-year-old, 4-year-old, 5-year-old, 6-year-old when you're in your 40s is different than when you're in your 20s.
Yeah, I think some things are easier and some things are harder.
Give me an example of each.
It seems I've done everything I've wanted to do. as a professional, as a person, you know, I've had my freedom and I've done everything, and so I don't resent or regret a single moment. You know, Salam doesn't get babysitters because I don't want to go out. I've done that. You know, now I'm her mom. And I think, you know, in speaking with other kids who, parents of kids her age, I think that is really different because many of these folks are, you know, fairly newly married and they really miss dates and they wish they could travel to Europe and they wish they could volunteer. And I hear that. I mean, their time is going to come when their kids are older. Mine just came first. And so I'm just extremely, extremely content. And I think that's a nice bonus. You know, some of the hard things are, you know, I don't have the same energy as people who are younger. And, you know, you also just definitely compare at the school pickup line. You're like, oh, wow, you're really young, and I'm really not. But, you know, it's, considering the alternative, I'd rather be an older mom than not be a mom at all.
Tell us a little bit about the finances of adopting a child internationally. How much does it cost?
You know, I don't remember that exactly. I think different programs cost different amounts, and you're paying, of course, for the service, and you're paying for lawyers, and you're paying for social workers, and you're paying for people who take care of the children while they're in country. And, you know, so various people charge various amounts, so different agencies charge different amounts for that. I was very lucky and had a scholarship that was particularly for adopting children that were a little older, because generally people want infants. So I did not have as high of a fee as other people have. I remember it felt like a lot of money, but it also was nowhere near what other people had to pay.
Where did the scholarship come from?
The Gates Foundation. The scholarship was, the foundation gave the money to the agency, and the agency gave the money to me. So the Gates Foundation doesn't know who I am, but I know who they are. and so, you know, and then, of course, after you're back, there is an adoption tax credit that will, you know, help you out on your taxes for a percentage of the expenses. So kind of loan money and get it back later.
Ministers are not known for having extraordinarily high salaries, particularly college campus ministers and college chaplains. Did you feel it was going to really put your personal life in a financial pinch when you adopted?
Things are tight, but it's doable. I mean, I am so, so beyond blessed for the benefits program that we have at Yale, and that really makes a big difference. So, you know, I don't pay anything for health insurance, and I have, everything is covered. And I know that that is a big expense that many other families are dealing with, and I don't have that. And also, you know, as I said before, you know, I don't have expenses for entertainment and travel and, you know, meals out other than, you know, family-friendly restaurants. So, you know, you make money for what matters to you. And you know, things are tight, but things are fine. And it's, she is not lacking for anything. And some of the things are definitely, some of the perks in life have definitely come from grandparents as well.
Now, when you go out with Salam, and she's obviously of a different race than you are, how do people react?
Some, we definitely are what the adoption agency called a conspicuous family, and that is definitely true. And generally speaking, people are good. I mean, they don't necessarily recognize that we're a family at first, and sometimes that's a little hard.
What do you mean?
You know, I've had circumstances where people will try to find a mom for Salam, and experience there, where some parents were convinced that Salam was alone at the zoo, even though I was standing right there, because they didn't see anybody who looked like Salam watching her. And that's a little hard on her, and she doesn't really quite understand it. And kids are very curious, and sometimes that's hard for her to hear. She's pretty matter-of-fact about it, but, you know, kids are used to the idea that you look like your parents. And adoption is not really something that very young kids have language for, unless it has personally impacted their family. It's just not part of their understanding. So, you know, she and I both get tired of answering the questions of why don't we look alike.
What answers have you come up with?
Oh, I just say the truth. I said she didn't grow in my stomach. You know, she had another mommy, and that mommy isn't able to take care of her anymore, and so now we're a family. I just try to cut it short.
How does Salam answer?
It's pretty much the same way. She says, because I didn't grow in her tummy.
Uh-huh.
And I have two mommies. So, tries to cut that conversation. We both try to cut that conversation off without being rude to children, because I think many of them just haven't been exposed. They have no idea what's going on.
Have you had to prove that you were Salam's mom?
Yeah, at airports. You know, we carry passport cards everywhere because, particularly at the airport, there's not always an instantaneous acceptance that she is who I say she is.
I want to get back to that in a minute, but it's about 20 minutes until the end of our Keeping the Faith program this Sunday evening. Let me take a moment again to introduce our guest. We're talking with Susan Olson. Reverend Olson is on the staff of Yale Divinity School. She's the Director of Career Services there, helping graduates from YDS find positions after they finish their time there at New Haven. She's a former college chaplain, a campus minister at Wilson College, at Wesley College, Connecticut College, and was also in the chaplain's office at Yale. She does supply preaching, particularly in the summers, and she is the single mom of a six-year-old daughter from Ethiopia that she adopted 3 years ago. She's the author of a very popular blog called The Sky Is Laughing. You can find that by looking for the Sky is Laughing blog on your search engine, or go to theskyislaughing.wordpress.com. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. And I want to take just a moment to thank Don Nolan. Professor Nolan filled in here the last three Sundays, as he has done many times before over the 14 years of this program here on WILL AM 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. These programs are also heard live online. You may have a public radio app that you listen to. You can use to listen to this program as well as others here on the station. Or perhaps you have gone to will.illinois.edu, which is also where you can go to hear parts of this program if you missed it, or all of our other archived programs. This Sunday's program will be archived within a week or two, maybe even sooner, and you can hear it in its entirety if your schedule makes it impossible for you to hear it all live. Again, that's will.illinois.edu/keepinthefaith. Let's go back talking to Susan about her experience with Salam. That's spelled S-E-L-A-M. It means peace. That was the name given by her birth mother. But Susan was delighted to continue that. Tell us a little bit, Susan, about how you deal with child care. Like, where is Salam right now while you're talking on the phone on live radio for an hour?
Well, right now Salam is enjoying a little bit of kids' PBS, which is her favorite thing in the world to do, and something we try to parcel out a little bit more. So when she said, "I can watch for a whole hour," I'm like, "Go for it." So yeah, right now she's being babysat by the television, which is not something I recommend on a regular basis, but it is working right now. So.
Now she's 6 years old. Do you limit her screen time per day, per week? How do you do that?
Well, unless I am being interviewed on the radio, she gets one free show a day.
Is that 30 minutes or an hour?
I think like 25 minutes. Okay. Sure. It's we only get PBS Kids. We don't have any of the other channels. And she can buy more by practicing her math skills. So basically, she's been practicing a lot of math this summer, but she hasn't figured out that it takes so long to complete the math skills that, you know, often then it's time for bed. But, but sometimes she can get another show. I just, you know, there's, you know, it's good quality programming on PBS Kids, but it's a big world, and I want her to experience more of it. So we do a little bit of bargaining around that.
Susan, I know we're talking to you via your cell phone. I'm noticing a little bit of distortion. Is it, you might want to plug it into the charger in case its battery is fading.
And
if it was plugged in, maybe you need to just be a little closer to it. I'm not sure.
Okay, sorry.
That's quite all right. We could hear you all right, but it was just a few words we were losing. And also, I'm getting older. I am 70, and it's harder for me to hear, I'll admit. And I might just mention to listeners, I had mentioned earlier before I was gone for 3 weeks that Keeping the Faith will be coming to an end in at the end of August. I've been hosting it and producing it for 14 years, as I mentioned, and with my age and wanting to do a few other things. I've loved volunteering for this program, and I've loved supporting WILL, but I feel it's time to bring it to an end. And so I had announced that earlier. Listeners do need to know that's totally my decision. The station seemed to be happy to have me here, but I felt it was time to bring this to a close. So we will be having 7 more programs after this one, and we have a great lineup for the summer, and I hope you can tell from the quality of this program that we're trying to end on a real up note here on Keeping the Faith. It's been fun for me all these years. When I was in Portugal for a meeting for the Rotary International, I had the interesting experience of leaving the same day that the jazz tenor saxophone player, whose music you hear at the beginning and end of this program, John Ellis, was just arriving in Portugal to begin teaching some jazz there for a few weeks. And so we just missed John Ellis, but I've enjoyed having his theme music, which he very generously donated to the show 14 years ago. He has quite an international reputation now, and so I've been happy to have had the benefit of his music all these years. Susan, you traveled internationally before you had Salaam, and you've said now you're not doing that very much anymore by choice. When you work, what kind of child care have you arranged these last 3 years for her?
What has been... the summer is different from the school year.
Okay.
In the school year, she goes to the Jewish Community Center for after-school care 3 days a week. And that is where she also went to preschool. It is a really familiar place to her with lots of people who really know and love her. So that's 3 days a week, and 2 days a week I have flex time. So I come and pick her up from school and get to spend time with her when she's still really alert. And then I log back onto my computer, and I work from home from 8 to 11 to make up for that early dismissal. I've been really fortunate that my employer is flexible in that regard and has been able to set up that arrangement for me. It's been really useful to us.
Now, that's Yale Divinity School. Does Yale University have a similar flex time program for parents?
Yes, yes. I mean, you have to set it all up ahead of time and get everything approved by many people. It's the university's policy that you can ask. And my supervisor at the time was very open to it, and her supervisor. Both of those people have left the university or have left the position they're in, so I'll be renegotiating that pretty soon. But, you know, even if it's not continued, I've been grateful for the time that we've had together in the alert afternoon hours. in the summer, she goes to a series of day camps. So she's just finished a week of Girl Scout day camp. Then tomorrow morning, I'm going to a writing workshop, and she is going to Camp Grandma and Grandfather in upstate Illinois. So she is so excited about that. She will be there for a week, and then we'll be at the JCC for 4 weeks. They have a day camp program.
That's the Jewish Community Center.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, it's not a bad life at all. She's swimming every day a couple times a day and has dance class and nature and arts and crafts and some exciting field trips. She's got a really good summer ahead of her. I'm a little jealous.
Now, you've enjoyed being at camps yourself as a counselor, as a director and all that. Tell us about that.
Sure. I grew up in Girl Scout camping and worked at Girl Scout camp for many, many, many years. Also spent a couple years at Interlaken working at the National Music Camp. And then ultimately ended up directing two Girl Scout camps for a couple years at one, a couple years at another. And when that had to end, because until I came to Yale, I had 10-month contracts. So I had the opportunity to have a summer job. So when that had to come to an end, I became a volunteer for the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp, which is Paul Newman's camp for kids with life-threatening illnesses, and it happens to be here in Connecticut. And I also have volunteered for their sister camps, which have been popping up every year. It seems like there's another sister camp in the Hole in the Wall Gang Association. So I volunteered for two of the other camps as well, which has been a really great way to keep your hand in the most fun part of camping.
And do you take Salam with you?
We have done a couple of weekends. I mean, I no longer am able to volunteer because I'm raising Salam. But there have been a couple of weekends at the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp where I have gone up for the weekend with Salam to serve as a backup parent for the camp doctor who has a son who is about Salam's age and who is also adopted. And so I watch her son together with my daughter at camp, which has been really fun, too.
Tell us about the frustrating parts of adopting in terms of bureaucracy, paperwork, legal issues, government.
Well, all of those things that you've mentioned. You know, there is a lot of paperwork, but there are a lot of delays. And I experienced, too, just unexpected delays, which made it a little bit longer for me to get here. But, you know, it's frustrating and it's hard because you're in a hurry to do this. But that paperwork and those delays are all there for a reason. And certainly want everything to be done on the up and up. And you want every child who is adopted to be a child who needs to be adopted. And so a lot of those delays and paperwork are to ensure that the children are being adopted because this is the best option for them. And, you know, we're always worried about issues like child trafficking. And so it's frustrating at the time, but they're necessary delays and necessary paperwork. Many trees died in my process, I must say.
A lot of paper and a lot of emails, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Tell us about the joys.
Oh, there are no words for the joys. I mean, you're a parent. A lot of people are parents. They, you know, raising kids is just like the best thing in the world, I think. She's the best thing that ever happened to me, and I would do it over again in a heartbeat.
Your feelings may change when she's a teenager.
I don't know. She's so awesome. I think she'll still be awesome as a teenager, but she will probably drive me crazy.
What resources would you recommend to people who are considering an international adoption, interracial adoption, those kind of issues?
Oh, wow. I wish I had these names at the top of my head, but I would strongly encourage people to do a lot of research. As I said earlier, child trafficking is a constant concern. And there are good agencies, and there are better agencies, and there are agencies that I would not consider to be very ethical. So you have to do a lot of research. You have to double-check, triple-check, check the child's story, because you don't want to be in a situation where this child comes to you and you later discover that they were not intended to leave their home country. I recommend you do as much reading and begin it now about cross-racial adoption. Any book you can find is better than no book. Blogs are actually a really helpful way to kind of get inside the day-to-day life of living within a cross-racial family. And the onus of parenting a child cross racial lines is on the parent. It's not the child's responsibility to adapt to your culture. It's your responsibility to blend them. That's not the word I want.
Help them adjust?
I think it's my responsibility to provide Salam with absolutely the most amount of exposure possible to her, both her Ethiopian culture and African-American culture. It's not her job to just become like my family. It's my job to make sure that she has those opportunities, because even if she's living in a white family, a majority family, the rest of the world sees her as being part of a wider culture, and I owe it to her that she knows as much as possible and has been exposed as much as possible, both to the rich, rich history, but also to role models. And it's very important to me that she goes to a multiracial school, and by that I mean truly multiracial, not just a very small percentage, that we live in a truly multiracial neighborhood, that we seek out healthcare providers, teachers, everything, people for her to look up to who look like her. Particularly a child who comes from a country where everybody looks like her and then moves to a country where there's not that many people who do in their first couple months. It's extremely important to me to continually increase that. And actually the JCC has been an important piece of that, because there's a decent number of Ethiopian families that immigrated to Israel and have had a role in the JCC. And just the way that particular JCC works, and I don't know if this is universally true or just our JCC, there's a really large percentage of African-American members, particularly children, and a lot of the counselors at her camp and in her after-school program are...
I'm going to have to interrupt Susan. She's been talking about the Jewish Community Center in New Haven and similar ones like that. We are out of time. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for Keeping the Faith. We've been talking with Susan Olson, author of The Sky is Laughing blog about her experience with her adopted daughter from Ethiopia. Susan is on the staff of Yale Divinity School. Next week here on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking with Dr. Todd Farley about his mime ministry. Listen to hear if there are any sounds that come out. Thank you, Susan, for being on the program. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
This week in This American Life, woman goes into a casino, plays blackjack, loses a ton of money, and then sues the casino. Which, of course, raises a question.
What? Why is she not liable? It seems like if you go to a casino, that's like, you know what you're doing.
Because at the time of those losses, she has...
Stories about blackjack this week.
Saturday afternoon at 1 and Sunday evening at 6 on AM 580.
This week on the Evening Concert, we'll have Beethoven's 2nd and 3rd symphonies from Deutsche Welle Radio. Then pianist Emmanuel acts as the soloist in Beethoven's Emperor Concerto from Chicago. Wednesday, the Tokyo String Quartet plays Haydn's 27th String Quartet in Santa Fe. Then Thursday, it's a special on Romantic era composer Zygmunt Stachowski. Friday is prayer performances with Roger Cooper. That's the evening concert, Monday through Friday evenings at 7 on FM 90.9.
This American Life with Ira Glass is on the schedule next here on WILL AM 580 and WILL FM HD3 Urbana and streaming online at will.illinois.edu. This week on the show, Blackjack, stories about the casino game everyone thinks they can beat. I'm Jason Croft with you this Sunday evening. Coming up in an hour, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. In the first part of that program, Writing the Fantastic. Then at 8 o'clock, a program titled The New Alone.